Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where we're changing the questions that will change the world. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about our human potential for creating more healthy and humane places to live. I am so pleased to welcome Daryl Smith as my guest on Making Change. Daryl is the former deputy mayor of community for the city of Seattle. Leading up to his stint in city government, Daryl spent decades as a community organizer and community developer. And before that, he was an actor who moved to Seattle from Southern California in an effort to immerse himself in a different kind of community, Seattle's vibrant theater community. With that thread of building community running deep throughout his varied careers, it is my pleasure to have Daryl Smith share his observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Daryl Smith. Welcome, Daryl.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the welcome. I'm pleased to be here.
Oh, I'm excited to get into this conversation. Before we really dig into the meat of it, you have had such an interesting life. Could you share some of the highlights of the journey that it has taken from start to finish? Give us the history of your life in 3 minutes.
Well, thank you so much for calling it interesting. I appreciate that. Meandering with multitudes of stops along the way might be how I categorize it. Beginning in about 1987, I moved from northern New Jersey, where I was born and raised, having graduated from Franklin and Marshall College, about an hour outside of Philadelphia. I went to graduate school in San Francisco in the professional theater. I trained as an actor at American Conservatory Theater. Wow. In San Francisco, a very well-known repertory theater company that happens to have a conservatory attached to it. So received my training there, and then in about 89, began working in the professional theater in and around the Bay Area, ended up in Los Angeles with my new wife, Andrea John Smith, and we ended up meandering up to Seattle, Washington, which is where I currently live, primarily so that I could work in the professional equity theater. So for an actor with professional stage training, your goal primarily is to work as much as possible, but really it's to work in the professional theater. And Seattle, particularly at that time, and I think it's true today, is a very rich community for stage actors. Seattle has a long history of nurturing and forming professional equity theaters. I was amazed that when I moved to Seattle, people had little stickers in their windows and on the backs of their cars talking about which repertory theater they were members of. So that was astonishing for me.
And
realized I'd landed in a pretty great place where people really cared about storytelling and nurturing a community of actors. So for me, that was a great place to really forge ahead in my professional career. So here I was in Seattle, and I moved to at that time, a long forgotten neighborhood in Southeast Seattle called Columbia City, where I reside today. And at that time, Columbia City had a lot of wonderful folks living in and around its neighborhood surrounding.
When was this, Daryl? What year?
I want to say that's about 1994.
Okay.
And essentially, what happened for myself and my wife, Andrea, is that we got involved with the neighborhood because the business district was like a little mini ghost town. It was primarily boarded up, and there were a few businesses there kind of hanging on by the skin of their teeth. But what happened was a lot of the residents, the neighbors, the renters and homeowners in little funky bungalows like the one I was in, we began meeting and talking about what we could do to make change on the ground in our little business district, because we all had one thing in common. We were getting in our cars or on the buses and leaving the neighborhood to do anything. And I mean anything. Get a newspaper, go to a pharmacy, go to a movie, get dinner. None of those things were really happening in our own neighborhood. And at about that same time, I got this crazy idea, because it was so difficult for a performing artist to purchase real estate, to buy a home, even a really cheap home in a forgotten neighborhood, as Andrea and I had done, that I felt like I could help someone else do that. So in 1995, I got a real estate license and began focusing on selling what I call recycled housing in forgotten neighborhoods. That was my niche. So I got pretty good at it. So good, in fact, and got into it, I think, at the right time, that it became more and more challenging to continue my work as an actor, because the last play I had done with A Contemporary Theater, a wonderful equity company here in Seattle, I was in rehearsal And in those days, we were still using pagers on your belt. And my pager was buzzing. Yes, you remember.
Unfortunately, I'm just that old. Yeah, I do remember.
Well, I talked to young people today, and they're like, what? What is that? What is that strange technology?
Only showed a phone number.
Exactly. So my pager was going crazy, buzzing all the time with clients or people that were interested in working with me to purchase these recycled little funky bungalows in this kind of forgotten yet interestingly cool neighborhood called Columbia City. So I essentially retired from the professional theater and began to focus all of my work on real estate. And the reason why that worked for me is at the same time, getting involved at the neighborhood level in terms of community development and organizing, that area became a real area of passion for me, so much so that I felt like I could replace my love of acting and being in a community of artists with being in a community.
Wow.
So I made a little bit of a switch there, and it was really the best decision of my life because my meandering path has, as I look back on it, makes a lot of sense from the perspective of someone being actively involved in the community. So I became chair of Columbia City Revitalization Committee. We would hold town meetings and invite people in multi-languages because Southeast Seattle is home to so many different ethnic groups. There are probably upwards of 70, 80 different languages and dialects spoken in this end of Seattle. So we printed Come to a Pancake Breakfast in, I think, 7 or 9 languages at that time and had 200 folks show up, and we held a town hall. And basically, it was blue sky space. So at the front of the room were 2 microphones, and all around this room in this funky old Filipino restaurant with wonderful hosts, we said, any idea is a good idea. All you have to do is walk up to the room, take the microphone, say what your idea is, and we'll write it up on the board for you. 3 years into that process, doing a town hall every year, some of those ideas never happened, but a few really stuck. And now 20 years later, an idea I came up with called Columbia City Beat Walk begins its 20th anniversary season, which is you can walk in our neighborhood business district, go hear live music, whether it be blues or bluegrass, hip hop, or, you know, ska, whatever it is. And at that time, I would hire the bands, you know, produce the event, find other volunteers to take the tickets. We'd sell the tickets. And now 20 years later, it's become a real defining artistic endeavor for this community and has actually spurred other similar festivals, not just in Seattle, but in other states in the country. So those sort of community building events, grassroots focused, our garden tour became a city leading version where it's a neighborhood based garden tour. People would actually go and look at folks' gardens in their backyards and in their side yards and in their front yards in Seattle. Our farmers market idea took 3 years to develop, but we have one of the West Coast, deemed by Sunset Magazine, most interesting farmers markets in the country. That was another idea that was grassroots driven and developed from that first town hall meeting of people walking up to the front of the room and taking the mic and having their idea thrown up on the wall. So this idea of community-driven change and community being involved is something that's really defined my life. I continued my work as a realtor, but really at the same time, it was just a vehicle so I could do civic work. And that's really been the passion of my life. Here I am in Seattle now. I just finished serving 4 years as deputy mayor of the city of Seattle. And my boss, Mayor Mike McGinn, we lost our recent election, so we're all out of office now. But the legacy we really left, the defining legacy, is the fact that in 4 years, we conducted over 150 town halls, community meetings, walking tours, and forums. And our whole goal was to bring city government to the people as close as possible. So we were out in the community a lot, obviously 150 times, taking our working cues, our plan development, and really some of our policy development directly from the desires and the concerns of the community. And I think that's a real testament to that idea of grassroots community-driven change.
First of all, I'm just taking a deep breath and breathing in. It is a wonderful meandering path. And it's always so fun for me. I always watch people when I ask this question, and we never realize we're on a path until we look back behind us and go, oh, I see where everything was leading. And, you know, it all just feels like sort of stuff we're doing. And it's obviously been leading to something pretty powerful. In all of your years, And I count the power of being in a community of theater as well. As you've been looking back over all of the different changes that you have seen, when you see change happening in a community, what are the factors that you see undergirding that change, regardless of where it's happening?
And I think you're exactly right, because as I do look back on it, it makes a heck of a lot more sense than when you're in the middle of it in terms of that meandering path. And I think for me, the common denominator, whether it be working in the theater or neighborhood activism or city government, is really the involvement of people. Very clearly to me, we landed in a pretty cool neighborhood that had just not really been organized particularly well. And so our job as neighborhood activists were to bring as many people in as possible. And in my time in city government, that was the DNA of our administration, to bring as many people in as possible, to throw city hall's doors open. So we started an annual city hall open house where, again, we would, in multi-languages and through all of our different means, through our different city departments and agencies, get the word out that, you know, city hall is wide open today. Come on down. We've got entertainment. We've got food trucks, you know, see the different departments. And hundreds of people came and literally lined up all day long to take tours of the mayor's office and see where they could get a dog license and adopt a cat or have a complaint filed about a pothole, these sorts of things. And it also led to the development of many online tools as well, because the goal is really to bring people in. And I think organized communities are healthy communities. That is absolutely true, I think, across the world. The more organized the community is, the more actively engaged they are, the better we all are for it.
Tell me a little bit about what that looks like. When you talk about organized communities, tell me what you mean by organized communities.
Well, for example, when there's an issue that is important, that is an issue that affects a neighborhood or a community or the whole city, the level of involvement of citizens is hugely important. And it doesn't mean this is easy. Sometimes it actually means it's a lot harder. But having those public meetings where people show up and feel like, not only should I be here, I need to be here because I need to be part of what the outcome is or the policy development. That's what I mean, in a sense, by organized communities in terms of how the city interacts with its citizens. If it's community-driven stuff, I think the same is true. In the early days of Columbia City's rebirth or renaissance, you know, 20-some years ago, we would literally go door to door to invite people to things. And not just residents, business owners too. Business owners also needed to be at the table. So when you have residents, whether they're renters or owners, business owners, nonprofit organizations that are also there in the community, all at the table, you can get some great things done. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be easy, because obviously the more diverse a place is, the more people you have at the table, the more opinions there are.
Right.
And those opinions have to be accounted for. Everyone has the right to be heard and express their concerns and throw new ideas up on the board. And then it's really up to the folks to make sure that together you do the hard work of coming up with compromise and making sure those ideas that have the most juice behind them live to see the light of day and then continue on, because some can become some of the defining signposts of a healthy community. And I think that's really what it's all about.
It's really interesting, because you talk about the involvement of everybody. And it occurred to me, as you were saying, that everybody needs to be at the table. Your statement that organized communities are healthy communities suggests that there's a table. And what's occurring to me as you're talking is that the convening part of that, the bringing together, that's the organized part, because you've got people who care. You clearly had people who cared in Columbia City, and it's the existence of a table to come to and somebody holding that table open and inviting people to that table. It's a really interesting difference.
That's exactly right. And I think it really is a good visual for listeners to hold on to, because in many communities, you're right, there isn't a table. And so part of what you have to do is create that sort of context. There is a place to go to. And so for us, the table was this town hall that we devised, where we would invite people and we'd have a convening place, a place where you could go to engage in that type of dialogue. And in my time, you know, serving as deputy mayor here in Seattle, we felt like it was our job to make sure that that table was created in places where, in immigrant and refugee communities, for example, where maybe there wasn't necessarily a table, because maybe the country you came from, the last thing you wanted to hear is from the government, right?
Yeah.
We had to create a safe place. So we used many of our initiatives. A couple that come to mind are safe communities, where we went citywide and held, I don't know how many meetings it was, hundreds, literally, whether they were in neighborhood community centers, living rooms, or large forums, to hear from the community, what do you need to feel safe in your neighborhood? And that's a very broad, open-ended question that led us to a lot of different sorts of buckets where we could then focus our policy work to get at those answers. And that could be around policing, but it could be a lot of other things as well. So yeah. Making the table is hugely important if it doesn't exist. If there is a table there, then your job is to make sure that there are plenty of seats to go around, because sometimes what happens also is the folks that have a sense about how the system, whatever system works, mm-hmm. they know how to be at the table. So what you need to do then as an elected official with lots of good, hardworking staff, as my boss, Mayor Mike McGinn, had, was making sure that you created those new chairs. We had to go out and make sure that not just the usual suspects, and bless them for being at the table and understanding how the system works, it's your job then to explain that to people that have not been at the table so their voice is heard as well.
You talked a little bit about people who being at the table has actually been a scary thing. The last place they're going to have trust is at that table. What have you seen work in creating that trust, that safe space? It's one thing to say, we're having a town hall and any idea is a good one, just grab the mic.
Right.
What have you seen that creates an environment where people are willing to step up and take the mic in their hand?
That is a great observation. You're exactly right. And I certainly learned this firsthand in my time working for the city, and less so as a neighborhood community activist. We tried our very best, and we weren't always successful at getting those sort of disparate and not usual suspects there. But I think about the quote from the great civic activist Cesar Chavez, when he was asked, well, how did you do it? How did you organize all of these farm workers to have this kind of power? He said, and I'm paraphrasing, talk to one person, then talk to someone else, then talk to someone else, then talk to someone else. And the more you can engage people on an individual human level, the more trust you can build. And so part of our job was to make sure we knew who the leaders were and even who the leaders weren't, and make sure we were getting to them and then all of their connections to talk to folks individually, so that we built that kind of trust so that when a meeting does come up and you go out to the Somali community, which is quite large here in Seattle, and you say, we really want you to be at this meeting, to be a part of this discussion, because you walk on sidewalks too, or city light rates affect your family as well, or public safety is your issue too. It's not just an issue for those folks that are connected. You need to be a part of this conversation. When you build that trust, you can get a lot more people involved. And the thing about going as broad as you possibly can and involving the not usual suspects is your policy development on the other end will be markedly different. How you execute things is markedly different had they not been at the table.
I'm just loving what you're talking about, because our first instinct, government especially, but in the entire world, business, nonprofit, doesn't really matter. Our first instinct is we'll have a meeting. And you're just turning that on its ear. The first instinct isn't we'll go one-on-one, because that would take a lot of time.
Well, sometimes.
Of course it takes a lot of time, because if you're talking about building trust, trust doesn't happen overnight. And I love that whole thought that, no, it's not the first thing we do is have a meeting and ask who's interested. The first thing we do is ask one-on-one and get to know people and build that trust, so that when you have the meeting, they actually show up.
And one of the things that Seattle does that I'm awfully proud of, and it certainly preceded our administration, we use the trusted advocate model. We have a name for it at city government, but I've gone to different places in the country to talk about what this model looks like.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Essentially, what you do is you find a way to contract with local advocates who may or may not be leaders. What we call in Seattle POLs, our public outreach liaison. That's a funny city speak way for basically saying you're a trusted advocate. So you go out to those individual members in communities. We have POLs, or polls as we call them, public outreach liaisons in the African-American community. We have them in the elderly community. We have them in the Filipino community. We try to get as many as possible, and you do small contracts with them. And the goal here is you're saying to them, we're going to provide you with training and dollars, and then you are the person the city will go to go out to your community that you know better than the city does. So we use those trusted advocates to bring people in to the conversation, because sometimes people are more comfortable having that meeting and that conversation in their own living room. They don't want to go to a public meeting. That's scary to them. So the trusted advocate model has been used largely in Seattle to make sure that we are getting as many of those voices that are not usual suspects, that aren't necessarily comfortable in a big public forum, that aren't comfortable coming down to City Hall. Whatever their barrier may be, we're trying to break those barriers down by using the trusted advocate model, because those are the individuals, men, women, old, young, that know their communities best. So we use them to make sure that we have the richness that Seattle is reflective of in those conversations. And we make our policy decisions based largely on those sort of conversations. So yes, we're going to come up with ideas, but we want to use all of the POELs, for example, to get feedback on that idea before the idea is launched. That's a model.
Can you share a story? Because I'm just fascinated with this. Can you share a story about one time, an example of this?
Sure. I mentioned earlier, we did under Mayor McGinn a big effort called Safe Communities. And it was a basic open-ended question. Seattle had gone through in, I think, 2011, our second year in office, a rash of shootings and a spike in crime. Now, for most major American cities, this might have been just a blip, but for Seattle, it shook us kind of to the core. So we engaged on an initiative because we wanted to ultimately find out, is there, and it turns out, yes, there is, some misunderstanding or some mistrust between community and our police force. We wanted to make sure that those barriers were being broken down as much as possible. So we opened it up to say to folks, what do you need to feel safe in your community? Because we suspected that the answer might be different depending on which community you were in. So We used our whole POL network, Public Outreach Liaison Network, as trusted advocates to go out and ask these series of questions to these different communities. So we went really big. We had over 3,000 participants across the city. So we knew we were getting a good sample poll of what those concerns would be. And we asked at each table in a big community setting, please elect one person from your table that will go to the next meeting. So we kept using those POLs, that public outreach liaison model, to make sure we were going as deeply as we could in the individual communities. And as a result, we were able to sift down all of these responses. And that is what helped develop our way forward in terms of our policy directive for helping to train and sometimes retrain our police department. We got a lot of incredible new answers and information, things we hadn't thought of. And I think that's really because we started out with a much wider funnel at the top, and you only get the wide funnel by having as many voices in that conversation as possible.
So what are some of the things that you came up with that you might not have come up with otherwise?
Here's a real easy one. Police officer in certain neighborhoods where there's a high degree of immigrant refugee or African-American or whomever, they might see a police officer, let's say, going into a Starbucks, right? It's Seattle, after all. Mm-hmm. And that individual might feel like, well, I shouldn't talk to the police officer because they're grabbing a cup of coffee and then they're running out to do a call or whatever. And what we started doing is we began asking our officers to frequent the coffee shops, to sit down at the table and have a little table tent that says, I'm not busy. I'm on duty. I'd love to talk to you.
Wow.
And we had them develop a language card in multi languages that could be handed out to community members so that they understood that the cops were essentially on your team. And here's emergency information that you may need, because, again, that language barrier in a place as diverse as Seattle, that could be a barrier. So we didn't know any of this before we started our Safe Communities work. We got these answers because out of that giant funnel, because of all the different voices, we heard things like, I'm afraid to talk to the police, or I'm not sure I'm supposed to talk to the police, or I have a language issue. English is my second language, and I'm uncomfortable with speaking to the police or, frankly, city agencies because I'm concerned about language being an issue. These are the sort of things that you get out of it if you actually go deeper.
This is so applicable to absolutely anybody trying to do anything in life, and it really doesn't matter government, for-profit, this is just amazing stuff.
Well, thank you. It's something we're awfully proud of here, and we continue to use it in Seattle, and I think it still is very, very rich and absolutely true on so many levels. And I have that based on the fact that when I've explained how the POLs work in other jurisdictions, you know, I've had the pleasure and honor to travel and represent Seattle. People are astonished, and it's not like you're telling them something that is this new language. They intuitively know that it makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, one of the other things that is also becoming clear in what you're talking about is we talked about the fact that, yeah, there needs to be a table. There really needs to be somebody who sees their role as inviting people to that table.
Yes.
And government is naturally in that position, frequently doesn't take that role.
That's awesome.
But it can come so naturally to them. There's others throughout the community benefit world, whether that is at a on-the-ground grassroots organization, whether that is at the foundation level. It really can be anybody that stands up and takes the role of convener. That is actually the one that says, okay, yeah, we have a table, and yeah, we see who's out there. I'm going to take responsibility for bringing people to that table.
Right, right. It's very interesting for me. My full title was Deputy Mayor of Community. And I Googled, you know, just thinking, well, who else is out there that, and I couldn't find anybody. Actually, there's plenty of, you know, in bigger cities, deputy mayor of public safety or, you know, education or whatever. And these are important things, but we were being very intentional in our administration that we wanted very visibly to have a high level staffer whose job it was. My book of business was anything that happened in the community. And naturally, I dealt most closely with the departments that also had lots of contracts with nonprofits in the community or were specifically there to engage with our citizenry. So that was really a big part of my role, to be that rather public face. There's no substitute for an active and engaged executive, your mayor or your governor or your president for that matter. But you need to also have people whose primary role is to let the world know the door is open. I really want to hear from you. And not just here in my office, but I'm going to be out in your neighborhood and your community as well.
Daryl, I have learned so much from listening to you. I have to share with you that running around in my mind is, wow, I wish you could come to my community and talk to folks here. So that may be our next conversation. Thank you so much for sharing all of this. It just feels so simple, so logical, so right. Things that folks can absolutely just take and run with. Thank you so much for sharing that with folks today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always pleased to talk about the stuff that drives me. I think it's important. It's also a lot of fun and just makes you feel great. So thank you.
Thank you, Daryl. Listening to Daryl talk about his work in community organizing and community building, I'm struck by how often we hear about making sure everyone is at the table without thinking more deeply about what it takes to ensure people are not only included, but valued and nurtured in their roles as citizen change agents. For that high degree of involvement and engagement to become the norm rather than the exception, what would it take? As Daryl pointed out, perhaps the first thing is that people need to trust that the table won't hurt them. If people are afraid of the police, break down that barrier. If people are afraid of City Hall, break down that barrier. I loved the examples Daryl shared, simple things any community group can do. A cop at a Starbucks with a tent sign that says, please talk to me. A regular open house where people can tour and eat and make City Hall feel like it's theirs. And perhaps the first step towards trusting that they don't have to be afraid to be at the table is having a network of their peers who demonstrate by their own actions that it's not dangerous to be involved. The City of Seattle's public outreach liaisons are that network of peers. And it is a testimony to the city's commitment to building that trust that they contract with those trusted advocates, they pay them and train them. That speaks volumes about a commitment to engaging people by meeting them where they are. Opening the doors to provide so many points of entry has another effect on making sure that everyone's at the table. The more an individual gets involved through all these points of entry, and the more they feel comfortable in rooms full of people brainstorming how to take back their city, the more it is no longer wishing they had a seat at someone else's table. That is when people take ownership of the table, ownership of their community, their neighborhood, their square block, or the few houses on either side of them. And at that point, we don't have to work so hard to get people involved. As Daryl's home community of Columbia City has proven, once people are engaged, those mechanisms for engagement can become significantly self-sustaining. Yes, those systems require ongoing care and feeding, absolutely, but they don't require the immense work they required as they were starting up. Engaged people stay engaged by engaging others. Which leads to questions for your own work. First, what could your organization accomplish for your community if you had more citizens involved in the work? What might be the result in your community if you engage twice or three times or 100 times the citizens you're currently engaging? And what might be the result for your organization itself? Second, what does your organization already do to engage citizens in your work? Where are you already opening your doors and inviting people in? Where are you already engaging citizens to engage others? How might you build upon those efforts to engage more and more people to create an army of support for the results you're working to achieve? And lastly, what would your programs look like if they were built by the community you serve, promoted by that community, and perhaps even executed by the community? What would it look like if your community members were not just the clients and patrons at your organization, but were actually the leaders and staff and volunteers that make your programs run? For some, this idea might be exhilarating, and for some, scary. What small steps might you take to make that idea less scary? Are there areas of your program where you might put a toe in to take a baby step towards having the community own and run even just one of your programs? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hilde Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For Creating the Future and the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you next month here on Making Change.